We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse. The fifth column.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, comrades, compañeros, and not comrades, we need today. Very special episode of this podcast. Is it okay, Matt? You look
I can't see you.
You don't need to see me.
No, but like it's
too much.
Looking at a lot of metal.
There's a lot of hardware in front of us.
Me and you.
Camille's not here, so it's all falling apart. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of The Fifth Column. This is going to be the greatest episode we've ever had because we have a great guest and Camille's not here.
Yeah.
The two of those things together, it's really going to, it's like, can you win an Emmy for a podcast, Matt?
No.
No.
But this is also the second time that we've been in. Did we christen this, by the way?
We did christen this before. Yeah. What did we call it before? This is a new studio, so we're talking
the third
about.
Nut. That was an idea from Kat Rosenfield when she was here.
That was what it was called.
Third Nut Studios.
Yeah.
The other science studios. At any rate, this is the second time we've been here. And the second time that we've had, two for two now, a guest that listeners have been clamoring for.
Oh, I literally thought you were going to say who had a vagina. I'm not joking. I literally thought you were going to say that.
Why not both?
Starting but off, we do have... It's funny, you want to have these big buildups to these great guests, and then you realize that the people who download it see it on their fucking player. It's like, Batya's on. Batya, Ungar, Sargon, my pal, someone who I think is wrong about almost everything except for the first book that she wrote, Bad News, right, was the name of that book. And you have a new book coming out, and you're here to flog it, and we are here to attack it.
Yeah.
Batya, tell us the name of the new book, Batya.
I'm so happy to be here. Even
I'm so happy to have you.
I know I'm not going to sell a single book, but it's just like bragging rights, man.
No.
It's bragging rights. I'm on the fifth column.
I said to our comrade here, who is owner of this studio, it's really hard to debate Batya because like you like her too much. I want people who are loathsome to debate.
Mm.
I can think of a few that maybe we were talking about before we started.
That? Aren't you doing that in like 24 hours?
Oh, pretty soon. Pretty soon. Although I did do a, and I want to give them a shout out because they're very nice to me, this newsletter Tangle. Do you know these guys?
Yeah.
So they had an event here in New York and I was on this panel with a friend of Batya's named Josh Hammer. The Hammer.
Seems like a fake name.
It's clearly a fake name.
Yeah.
He's on the run.
Poor name.
Yeah, he's like the one-armed man from The Fugitive. We have no idea where he came from, just out of nowhere. And then, was it Catherine Rampel?
Yeah.
From the Washington Post.
She's good.
And that was a lot of fun. I want to thank those people. It'll be a podcast that's up. I told them I'd give a little shout-out to it. The audience was great. Very Manhattan audience. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whose side they were on.
Batya, didn't you just do a debate? Leading lights of the universe. Lord.
Yes, a debate about Israel and Iran and all
You know, pull that mic in so we can really hate you. we want to make sure that we don't like you in a loud way. I saw that and I sent you an email about it because that was about Israel, Iran, and it was for Zero Hedge.
Oh boy.
Right?
I'd never heard of them before.
They're interesting. Yeah, interesting guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was you and Dennis Prager, very much not the person I think would be your debate partner, against the comedian Dave Smith and this guy who is ubiquitous and appears to have mental health issues named Cenk Uygur. Uyghur.
He was running for president for a hot minute there.
He didn't do very well.
No.
Because I didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
No, I know who he is. He's everywhere.
Also not born in the United States, which is kind of a...
Oh, yeah, because he's Turkish, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How did it go?
I never know how... I have no ability to, like, perceive from the outside how it went. There was definitely a lot of testosterone in the room.
Yeah.
And I always sort of go between like wanting on the one hand to like do my best by the people I know agree with me and give the most like, you know, shebang version of the argument. And then on the other side, wanting
the Shabbat version of the argument. Yes.
Like convince people who maybe are not on my side. And that requires a totally different tone.
100%.
And making those split second decisions in the middle of a debate when tensions are high and you're trying to like maintain your dignity and not descend into like a it was like a lot going on.
Who is the biggest dick?
You have to rephrase that so she'll answer it because you're not going to answer that question. you have to say something like this. You know, who did you think had the most sort of weakest argument, the most disingenuous argument?
I'm going with disagreeable.
Disagreeable, kind of like, yeah.
I'm like a cringe earnest person, so I went in trying really hard to find common ground, which I considered a huge win. I know, it's so gross, but I forced, in my attempt to do that, I forced both Cenk and Dave Smith to make what I thought to be pretty Zionist points at different parts of the debate. So I feel really good about that.
Headline, Dave Smith, Zionist.
Yeah. Convinced by Batya, who has an enormous Star of David on, by the way, in case you were not aware what side she was on. Just right there. But what was the argument that you got them, one of the two, to come a little bit towards your direction?
They both acknowledged that Israel had a moral responsibility to respond militarily to October 7th.
Mm. Yeah.
They didn't approve of the way it carried that out, although when I asked them, well, describe how you would have liked it to have happened, they described what Israel is actually doing. So that I felt, but I don't, like, that was clearly not something their audience, who were like the majority of the viewers, would have picked up on, I don't think. And that's kind of the, it's a really hard thing to do because they're, like, my viewer, my audience are not going to be watching this debate on this, like, weird, you know, website. And it was then streamed on Breaking Points, which is very far left, and on the Young Turks, which is very far left. And then Dave Smith has a huge audience.
Yeah.
I think it actually was streamed on PragerU as well. But so it's like, you're talking to people who really, really don't want to hear this. And it's hard because you want to, like I said, you want to do right by your people, your friends, your family, you know, the people who you think have been misrepresented by everything. But on the other hand, you really do want to say it in a way that, like, Dennis Prager was speaking to his audience
for
the whole time. And I don't feel like I have that luxury, because what if there's like one person you could convince, not convince to agree with me, but convince that my view is a legitimate view.
Yeah.
And to do that, you have to go in acknowledging that the other people have legitimate views, which is why I think it's very important to choose your debate partners very carefully.
Yes. Even when it's not your choice. But I think that's an interesting way of framing it, because, you know, I think most of these debates exist for the fans of the people debating to get or wait for a knockout punch.
Totally.
It's just saying, like, no one's going to be convinced by anything. You might get a couple things. And I appreciate the fact that you're trying to get a few people in the net behind the shrimp boat, like picking up weirdos that I'd be like, oh, actually, she has a good point. But usually it's just the echo chamber of people saying, like, yeah, you know, like Dave Smith's fans or Dennis Prager's fans, or I don't know if the other guy has any fans. I suppose he does. But I tried to watch it.
It was hard to watch.
It was a hard thing to watch. And I'll tell you why it was hard to watch. What you're saying about getting people to kind of understand what Israel was up against when they responded, there was a moment that I was watching where you were trying to establish something, and this is somebody who's doing a debate the right way, of what the civilian to combatant ratio of death is, because then we can kind of figure out if this is something that's gone morally astray. And people are getting very frustrated by that. Like, oh, you know, we're done with the numbers. Okay, the numbers. I know you don't trust the numbers. It's like, no. It's very important to establish these numbers, because the entire premise of it is you're indiscriminately killing children, women, civilians, et cetera. So if you don't establish that number, you're having a pretty hard time. And then there was a moment where it kicked over to the Cenk character. And I say character very advisedly, because he was playing this unbelievable role, this bluster, screaming and being like, you know, the Nazis and this. And it's like, you don't talk like that. Come on, man. That's not how you, it's not like Joe Biden. Come on, man. You're not that person. But he was, I find it like, I want to check out at that point.
Yeah.
Just because, like, I don't think people are having an honest conversation about that.
Yeah, and I kept asking him, like, what is the combatant to civilian ratio that you would have accepted as just? If the answer is zero civilians to combatants, is there any other conflict you would have demanded that standard for? I think there isn't. But I couldn't get, like, I kept asking, what standard would you want to hear? And even the moderator got annoyed at me because
I saw that.
But that is such an important question, and they will never answer it, and they will never admit. Like, when you say 33, when you mourn 33,000 dead, you are mourning dead Hamas butchers.
Yes.
Like, there should be shame associated with repeating that number. And on top of all that, Hamas has reduced the number to 22,000. Of course, like, nobody in the media.
Nobody
like,
noticed that. And why do you think they did that? I mean, there's a lot of speculation amongst a certain people who did pay attention to that. And I was speculating myself and saying, you know, I guess that the number of people that have run the numbers in this, like academics that said this is just actually impossible that this happened, that maybe they were trying to get a little respectability by lowering those numbers. I mean, because of course Israel had numbers of, you know, 1,300 dead and then lowered it to 1,100. I mean, they were giving an honest accounting of what was happening. Why do you suspect that they decided to maybe not be honest? Because at the same time, they're not telling you, like, disaggregating who's a combatant and who's not. But why do you suspect they lowered those numbers?
I think it's going to come out that the numbers are much lower and they're trying to save face and, yep, you know, some kind of credibility. I think that what happened was probably, I mean, I don't have any evidence for this, but what seems like happened is they were sort of using a predictive statistical model to simply increase incrementally, yep, the number of women and children killed every day. And, you know, what it became obvious, like, that had no relationship to the Israeli campaign, which has been very much in fits and starts.
Correct. Yeah.
And has been very corrective in many ways. You know, they started off just pounding northern Gaza, but then by the time they got to Khan Yunis, they were like a little bit smarter, a little bit more, you know, and each day they got a little bit
better. You adapt, right? You exactly understand
and
how to fight these wars.
I think there must be some feeling that, I mean, it was so obvious that this was nonsense because, do you remember, like, when they, you know, they claimed that that hit
the hospital.
The hospital story. But so they said 500 killed, the hospital was never hit, like, it was a parking lot. Obviously, it wasn't 500, but they didn't then reduce the number by 500 the next day. They just kept, like, it's like,
the funny thing about that was that the media, we got caught sort of flat-footed on, yeah, that one, right? And so they actually re-reported in like, I think the high number from the New York Times, and again, don't, you know, bust me on this because this is from memory and it was a number of months ago, that they lowered it to like under 50.
Yeah, yeah.
And it might have been even under 20.
But what's amazing is, do you guys remember that they staged a press conference holding dead babies the night that they claimed that this hospital was burned to the ground. So a close shot of a doctor holding dead babies, so you couldn't see that it was fake. I mean, obviously those were dead babies. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the idea of staging something so heinous that had not happened and that everybody involved in that footage knew had not happened, it's so macabre. And it's like there's this weird thing where, like, they envy the Israelis their victims. Like, they envy them the atrocities that were perpetrated against them. They have to flip everything. So, you know, oh, you say Hamas raped you, you raped us. Yeah. Oh, you say Hamas tried to, you know, wipe up out southern Israel, you're doing genocide. They have to reassign the crime to the Jews because the Jews are like the wokes. And this is the thing, like, the reason the wokes are siding with Hamas is because this is like my most cancelable take, but I feel like they
give it to us.
They recognize their move when they see it. Hamas is topping from the bottom, okay? They're saying, we have less power and therefore you have to do everything we say. We have zero moral responsibilities because you have more power. And so we are the victims. We are inherently, our abjection is our virtue. And that is the woke minds. I mean, that is the woke move, right? Like, however much power they cast themselves as powerless in order to make you their slaves. You have to do everything they say because they are the oppressed. It's like this, like, weird mindset, but it's like, it's the same model.
Yeah.
I've been interested to watch some people in the Israeli government or who are Israeli spokespeople asking, and this is multiple people by now, like, you know, do you think that we've reached peak woke on American college campuses? Like, super interested in that story right now. Mm-hmm. And it seems a little bit curious on one hand, but then you can completely understand it on the other, right? Like, David Bernstein had the book Woke Antisemitism that came out 2 or 3 years ago, which when it came out, I was like, ah, okay, really? All right.
Yeah.
And now, which I haven't read, of course, but I know David and I know his work. And I think that he's been largely validated, or at least, like, his theory has a lot more evidence to support it now, which is that if you look at intersectionality and those exact power relations that you point to, like, here's the victimhood, like, level, you have to, if you believe in that stuff, come to these conclusions and also not necessarily condemn people who do these awful, awful things.
But they don't believe it, right? I mean, because if they believed it, it would be sort of totalizing, right? I mean, you would believe this in every sort of iteration of it, in the sense that when you talk about something, I mean, there's a joke that we've always done on this podcast. Name anything. The last time we did this was the funniest one. Name anything and I'll find you an article online calling it racist. And Camille was wearing those fucking stupid Apple, like the Apple, what is it called? Vision Pro.
Snorkel face.
And yeah. I like literally Googled it while we were doing it. And there was an article about how it would like the racial politics of the Apple Vision Pro. Totally serious. And that is fine. Like you can do, you can sneeze the wrong way. And you'd be like, that is an example of white supremacy. And you see how flabby it is, right? And because they're so obsessed with it, we want to see, we're seeing all these things that are hidden. This is a subterranean thing that you wouldn't notice because we're trained in this, we notice this. But then when it comes to things like anti-Semitism, nothing is anti-Semitism.
Well, okay.
Absolutely astonishing to me.
So,
and I don't want to overuse anti-Semitism, by the way. And I know you're the same way. We've talked about this before.
Right, right. Yeah. So that, first of all, I totally, totally, I'm so grateful to you for starting on things we agree on because
yeah, it's gonna be a fucking bloodbath.
I actually think I disagree with David. Like, I don't think this is anti-Semitism. I think they're giving the Jews the white treatment, and yeah. I'm actually kind of annoyed at like the progressive Jewish community because why was it okay when they were treating white students like this? Why was it okay when they were talking about America like this? Like the Jews, like, you know, the whole ADL thing of showing up and saying, you got to include us in the DEI.
Yeah.
We're also oppressed. We want the trans treatment. We want the black treatment. We don't want the white treatment. I find that gross.
I think this is your most cancelable thing. Yeah, that's, I just want to add that. No, I think that's largely true. And I mean, during that debate, and I don't want to get stuck in this because we have a lot to talk about, but during that debate, I thought one of the most interesting things was a contrast. I was kind of, you know, scrubbing through it, as they say. And I got in this play and I just played a bit of it. And there was a long and deeply uninformed conversation about Nazism. And it was unbelievable. I was like, good Lord. I mean, can we have people who know less about this subject talking loudly about it? And it was like, you know, this is just like the Nazis. And it's funny, but beyond all the factual inaccuracies of this and the historical ignorance of it, it is a desperation that people have to wipe the Nazi thing clean by saying, even you do it. You thought there was a sort of unique nature of it, that the Jews were unique victims. And it's like, no. You do it too. And it's the comparison is inexact, and they'll acknowledge that in a kind of a way, but they just want to leave you with this idea that that thing that you were taught your entire life, that there's a Holocaust memorial in Boston. Why is there one there? It happened in Poland and happened in Ukraine. Why is this, you know, occupying so much space in the American mindset and the European mindset? And when it's so common and it's, they're not the only victims. And that's what you get out of it, because nobody who's even halfway serious can say that there's any, you know, comparison at all. I don't think it's a coincidence that Norman Finkelstein says it is a concentration camp.
Right.
And then, of course, wrote a book called The Holocaust Industry, which is about how Jews exploit the Holocaust for political capital, and then immediately mentions that his parents are Holocaust survivors. I don't know. That's pretty funny that you're doing that. Maybe you learned from your own book. But let's talk about another book. Let's talk about one that is as controversial as Norman Finkelstein's book. And that is one from Batya. Actually, no, before, let's talk about your old book first, actually. Let's keep this nice thing going and talk about bad news. Talk about the NPR stuff.
I'm right? going to repurpose this altogether.
Okay.
Which is to say, there are two journalists in America that I'm aware of who burn brightest when it comes to class rage. Mm-hmm. They're sitting at this table with me right now. And it's fascinating because you do it in different ways.
Yeah, it's true.
Michael does it in the wearing the stupid fucking pink shorts during summer kind of way. Batya does it by...
I'm like an undercover agent. I'm like working for the FSB. That's like an FSB move into the WASPs. They think that I'm one of them, and I'm like, you motherfuckers. I'm like taking notes.
Batya lives like an hour and 75 minutes away.
She lives in a cop bar, like actually in the basement of a cop bar. It's like unbelievable.
Was she actually in the bar when you did that incredible thing for Vice?
I think we hooked up. That was very weird. I was like, we didn't even know each other at the time. I was like, you're a writer?
That is true. I have thought for a really long time, having participated in media and being of a certain age, where like I remember the last of the maybe half of the people in a newsroom are not fancy lads. That age is dead. And
dead.
And for a long time, my kind of one of the main critiques that I had of the media, and I wrote a lot about the media, was precisely that people are writing about supposedly reality, and they don't have even a toe in the overwhelming reality of everybody. So I'm kind of curious, just like, because both of you at the table, of how and why you differ. Because I suspect you don't really have too much of a critique of her first book at all.
Because no, I don't. No, not at all. I mean, I thought it was brilliant, and I've recommended it on this podcast a bunch of times, and I will recommend it again, and I hope people go out and buy it. Buy it. It makes Batya happy, and she can move out of that firefighter breakfast place she hangs out in Canarsie or wherever the fuck she is. But no, I was, when I did this live event last night, there was a listener or a audience question and said, you know, how do we get the people in the middle of the country and flyover country to understand us and we understand them? This is, you know, in the, you know, West Village. And I said, look, well, I think you're
literally at the city winery.
It was literally the city winery. Yeah. And I was like, you know, I think you're misunderstanding this in a couple of ways. It is not about coasts. It's about cities and it's about wealth. It's about class. And there's upper class people in Minneapolis. There's upper class people in Kansas City. And that's why when you see those heat maps of elections, they're very blue. In St. Louis, they're very blue. In Kansas City, they're very blue. In Minneapolis, the same true in Texas, et cetera. Austin, it's not a coastal thing anymore. Understanding those people is something that is best looked at through the prism of class. And that was like people arching eyebrows. And I'm like, you've never thought of this? Truly? You've never thought of this? And I think that to Batya's book and to you know, throw it back to her in the context of her book, there are revolts at the New York Times. There were revolts at NPR. There were revolts at Spotify when Joe Rogan. There were revolts at Hachette when Woody Allen was publishing a book there.
TED this week.
There was a revolt at TED this week because they had the hideous, horrible Barry Weiss speak. Yeah. And God forbid they hear those ideas that they don't like. Why? Revolts don't happen in like local newspapers of people who, you know, are people from the neighborhood and have just been, you know, that this is an elite issue. That's why this happens. That's who's talking about. We don't have enough trans coverage when it comes to Gaza. Where are the trans people in Gaza? Okay. It's like, what are you talking about? Like, that thing exists because of major class differences. And my friend Alex and I have a game that anytime you see someone saying something completely idiotic, I've mentioned this in the podcast before, you see something said, absolutely dumbest thing you've ever heard in the media, and there's one of those every day, you get onto Google and you type the person's name in followed by LinkedIn. And immediately you'll find out they went to Columbia J School every fucking time. It's like never, you know, Occidental Community College or whatever it might be. It's always Columbia J School. It's they're all the same people talking about diversity constantly, but they're all the fucking same. They might have different hues of skin color, but they believe the same thing and they think the same way. And I think that for class, for me, I think that's the most important because in my universe, I would love for the black guy that they hire not to be the guy that went to you know, an elite private high school and then went to Yale. And I can think of one of those at the top of my head who's a very, very much talks about the black this, that, and the other and went to Phillips Exeter and then went to either Harvard or Yale or something. I want you to go to the projects and find a kid who's really promising there and really funny and really interesting and really good on camera. But that involves work. And this is about assuaging your bad moral conscience rather than actually lifting people up. That's not what it's about. It's never been about that. So I think for me, like why I care about that is like, if you're going to do that, do it right. And try to actually include people who aren't just elites of a different hue of skin color or maybe sleep with people that you don't sleep with or whatever it might be. And I think that's my, I mean, I think where we disagree is obviously not in this book and this kind of issue is something we'll get to is that's just how we alleviate some of this stuff and how we address it. But
maybe start with like, you wrote a book about journalism and then you realized the job was half done. So what did you realize was half done in that? And why did that lead you to this?
Yes, the book is called Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy.
What's up, David Bernstein?
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Yeah, Matt has a book coming out called Bad Jews, which I thought was really in poor taste.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a moment for
it. It's a moment for it. I think that, yeah.
Some sales opportunity.
You got that blurb from Brianna Joy Craig. No, I'm sorry. I could probably cut that, but
nah.
It's funny. I feel a little bit like cursed. Like every time I start a book project, I like my first thought is like, this is so obvious.
Yeah.
So embarrassing to write this book. Like how I remember I was interviewing you for Bad News and I was like, Matt Welch knows all this. Like, it's so embarrassing. I'm gonna, what, like, write a whole book about something that, like, he knows better than me? Like, it's like, it feels so obvious. Same thing with, like, my new book. I felt like this is all so obvious, but it isn't. You're right. Like, you say,
but that book did really well, right? Bad News did really well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that shows you that people are really interested in this stuff. Yeah.
I just basically noticed, like, what you were pointing out, that, like, the main problem with our media, we always talk about how the media is, like, really polarized between left versus right, but, you know, the reason that our media is terrible is not because it's leftist, although it is, it's because it's woke. And the reason that it is woke is because wokeness is a smokescreen for the class divide in America that the leftist elites have benefited from in a really big way. There's been, like, a big middle class squeeze, but a squeeze in both directions. And a lot of people who used to be middle class in jobs that used to pay a middle class wage, like, going to get to my second book, but, you know, like, be a college professor or a journalist, like, these used to be, like, not high working class, but journalism was a working class trade, not being a college professor, but they would pay, like, the same as a plumber, you know, like, same as other high working class jobs. And, you know, now, if you are in the knowledge economy, you are probably in the top 20%. And if you are a journalist, because of the collapse of the industry, there are so few jobs left. And what places like the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal and NPR have chosen to do with their ability to be selective is not go find the kids in the projects, but basically they have their pick of, like, the Ivies, and that is what they have done. And so the vast majority of journalists now not only have a degree, but a graduate degree. They have a degree. Their profile is similar to, you know, the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies in terms of education. And they live in neighborhoods with, like, all of the people in power who they were supposed to be covering adversarially. Their kids go to these private schools with all these people who they're supposed to be covering adversarially. And that's how
I don't think they even think about it covering adversarially. I mean, we're talking on Thursday night of a week where, my God, Catherine Marr has had a spectacular week, right? CEO of NPR.
She's great, by the way. She's a genius.
Yeah. I mean, it is Chris Rufo, who I think really this is the best work that he has done, is unearthed the tweets. This all came up because Uri, what's his last name? I'll go to Gellner immediately.
Yeah, because, again, you're anti-Semitic. But, yeah, they're all the same to you. But, yeah.
Wrote a piece for Free Press saying NPR has gotten too woke, too group thinking on the left. He was
immediately, which is like what Pacha said, is like, I can't believe I have to fucking point this out. Yeah.
And that,
like, you remember the joke on SNL with, what's his name? He was playing Mike Dukakis. The little you're gonna say Jewish guy, right?
I was waiting for you to.
But it's the
John Lovitz,
the great moment of John Lovitz when he looks at the camera when he's debating George H.W. Bush and he's like, I can't believe I'm losing to this guy. Like, that is right. Like, I can't believe I have to explain this.
The thing that Berliner left out of his piece was the class piece. So he really talked about the far leftification, but, like, this far left woke ideology is, like, it's not in the abstract. It is very tied to having gone to a fancy university. Like, it is a marker of class. It's like Tom Wolfe described this, like, you know, back in the 60s, right? Yeah. Like, this idea of radical chic, like, you burnish your elite credentials by showing how your views are so distant from the average middle class.
But is it ideology or is it Mad Libs? I mean, listening to this woman talk and listening and seeing her tweets, it is seriously just like, It's blanks that she throws in there, intentional equity.
Yeah.
Marginalized.
But that's the Wolf comparison is a very good one, because Radical Chic, which was an essay for New York Magazine, is about a Black Panther party at Leonard Bernstein's house. But the great thing about that essay, like, Otto Preminger is there, is that how little they know about it and how the Panthers are, like, intimidating them and they're just, like, taking it, like, I guess this is what we do. This is how we show that we are the good people. And that, you know, the thing about the journalism class and all these people going to these fancy universities, it's funny, when I saw the NPR story and I saw the fallout of it, him getting suspended, which I thought was the right decision, by the way, and I can defend that.
Fire him.
I would fire him. Yeah, it's against policy. You don't do that. But, you know, he does this. He gets suspended. He then resigns. And he resigns after Catherine Marr, who is the CEO of NPR, kind of went after him and said, you know, this is unacceptable, et cetera. Didn't say anything beyond that. And then 50 employees wrote a letter, which was then leaked to the New York Times, which very generously didn't include the name of the 50 employees, by
that
the way.
Was,
I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you for protecting us for this open letter that the Times is stumping for us.
And to be clear, the letter complained that people were spilling the dirty laundry of NPR in public.
Correct. And now, let's think about this in a very particular way. Imagine if there was a race-based problem at Amazon, at something, at one of these companies. In 2020, this happened a lot. There is no way that the CEO of that company would not come out, even if it was a violation of their policy to go out and speak publicly about it, and not say, we take this issue seriously. We're going to look at it, and we're going to address it. This was a flat denunciation. Then the employees, you know, they circled the wagons. And what that does for NPR and for journalism is it entrenches the elitism of it. Because if there's somebody that has slightly heterodox views, they're going to be like, I'm not going to fucking work at NPR. It's like, it'll be the most miserable job of my life. If they were to say, look, we're trying our best here. We understand the complaints. We disagree with some of them. We agree with some of them. But we're always trying to broaden our perspective, blah, blah, blah. Not saying everything's fine. This guy's a nut and we're gonna you know, cancel him or suspend him. When you do that, you are just entrenching this culture more and more and more and more.
Right. So the question is why, right? Like, how does it make a business sense, you know, to do that, right? How does it make business sense?
It's public radio and they don't give a fuck, right? It's there's no market pressures.
I think that it's more connect, because the same thing happened at the New York Times and the Washington Post and Wall Street Journal, and I mean, less Wall Street Journal, but a little bit, you know, yeah. All of the media outlets like Vox and The Atlantic, like they all kind of followed the same path, right? They all gave up on like the vast middle to cater to this like top 10% of over-credentialed, you know, multiple degreed college elites, right? So how does that make business sense? Theme explored at great length in Bad News. Basically, the business model for digital media is not based on just breadth of subscriber base, it's based on engagement. And of course, like the most engaged people are always going to be the most extreme. Yeah. But also, like in a model where the way that you make money, like digital ads don't pay anything.
Yeah.
What they do is they sell the data of their viewers and their listeners and so forth to third parties. Well, you know, the data of people who aren't rich is not worth very much.
Yeah.
So the incentive is actually to limit the people who are, you know, reading and watching and listening, so that you can then tell, you know, the people who want to advertise with you, like, actually, our subscriber base is really rich. And so when you give me an ad for a Cartier watch, you're not going to be wasting any dollars on, you know, somebody who's like making $60,000 a year who would never be able to buy one. And the New York Times figured this out back in the 1920s. Like, their model has always been, you know, cater to the elites, because that's who, the ads that we want to run. And so you can make more money that way. You don't have to appeal to the masses.
Although they were in a competitive market. So they like said, okay, we know that the tabloids are going to go to the immigrants. We're going to take these people out. The really insidious development was post all the newspaper consolidation after 1960, when, you know, every city that had seven newspapers now just had one. People said, you know what we need to be more like? The New York Times, in every way. And part of that way was to hive this off. I had a conversation with an LA Times ad executive about 20 plus years ago now about precisely this. Because it always comes up in the anniversary of the Rodney King coverage. Because we're like, oh yeah, we stopped covering South Los Angeles at some point, and that was kind of bad, wasn't it? Mm. And they will say, they would say back then when they were a monopolist newspaper making 25% profit margins, which is a hysterically high number.
It's insane,
And that was the industry standard for 30, 40 years everywhere in the country until there was no more, until there was actual
competition. I mean, William Randolph Hearst owned newspapers.
Yeah, he did.
Right? I mean, the richest man in America, he's a castle, for Christ's sake, but he owned newspapers.
He sort of leveraged himself.
Leveraged himself in lives, but that was
that
where,
castle. Yeah. But like the LA Times woman's like, we can't be all things to all people, which really meant we want to be the thing to the rich people. We have a monopoly, so let's not have these poor people mess around with our monopoly. And it drove me nuts as someone who came from a part of Southern California that was not getting necessarily coverage. And you would have like the murder paragraph on Mondays, and it would be two paragraphs on page B5, and it'd be like, oh yeah, 27 people got gunned down in South Central LA this week. But if anyone in Westwood or in some like fancy place, like a single Asian, you know, college student, got a stray drive-by bullet or something like that, front page for weeks and months. And I get some of that, but for the most part, no, I don't, because it's an artifact precisely of that. We wanted to hive off this captive audience and get the richest part of it, and we channeled coverage in that direction, and yet we still told ourselves stories at night that we were virtuous.
Bacha, I don't know if you pinpointed the time in your book of, you know, because the elites that you're looking for in the New York Times in the 1920s and 30s and 40s are not radicals. They're not leftists.
Well, that's the thing.
That's the interesting thing, right?
The thing that changed was, as recently as, like, I don't know, 20 years ago, it would have been considered very lame for a Democrat to read a paper that his squash partner, who was a Republican, could not read without being uncomfortable. Like, the elites 30 years ago, 20 years ago, like, that radical chic thing was not, like, mainstream in, like, the top 20%. No. People thought it was lame to read news that was, like, biased in one direction or the other. And the left, you know, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, was on the side of labor, right? Mm-hmm. And so you didn't have this, like, same weird thing where the leftists are the rich people now. The leftists becoming rich meant they needed to create an ideology to mask that, because they still wanted to have contempt for everybody else, and again, to burnish their status as elite. So when the left became rich, right, which is the result of the knowledge economy, see my second book, Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women, for sale at booksellers everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. After we talk about it, they're not going to buy it, but go ahead, yeah.
Like, basically, like, they needed an ideology to mask this, that they were now rich, they were now the elites on the other side of, like, the working class who they used to represent, and that's where wokeness comes from. That's where this far left intolerance comes from. It's a smokescreen, a way of portraying themselves as, like, somehow better than everybody else, even though they are the ones hoarding the American dream.
And it's really interesting to point out to people, and it's the one bit of information about the media, particularly in the city, to remember, a good kind of data point, is what is the most left-wing paper in New York in 1950? The New York Post. James Wexler is the editor of the New York Post.
That's
the editor
such of the a good point.
And he was a member in the 1930s of the Young Communist League, YCL. He was a young communist, maintained his kind of New Dealism, but he was a man of the left, because what is a tabloid? It's what we now call an outer boroughs paper. It's a working class paper, and it was a labor paper. And, you know, what was not really covered in America, in New York City, in the newspaper market at the time in the early 1940s? You had the Daily Worker, which was based out of Chicago, which was the Communist Party newspaper, but it was so ideological about the party. It was always about the party. So all of a sudden, they weren't attacking Nazis anymore in 1939 when there was the pact. And it was obvious to people. So you have that hole in the market, and then you have a newspaper totally forgotten about, a really interesting paper called PM.
PM, yeah.
And PM is like a tabloid, and it was focused on photos. It was like a very photo-heavy thing, and it was supposed to be for the immigrants, the working class, and it was a very left-wing paper. In, like, the big papers, you know, the Sun, the Herald, the Times, et cetera, were just, you know, mainstream papers that people who had money would understand. And it's amazing to see that flip. And I wrote a piece that is, I've mentioned it a couple of times, but it's been held actually because of the NPR piece, but it's coming out next week on Vice, and one of the, about my time at Vice. And, you know, I do, you know, very directly correlate that crazy downfall at Vice with the young people that filled the company coming from these elite colleges. And and as I said in the piece, it became a $5 billion college newspaper. Because they just had all this money and all these people with bizarro ideas. And the thing is that nobody was reading it, because what Matt said is absolutely right, and it's very important in this sense, is that the Mad Libs of it all, what does that mean? And I think that means a couple of things, but the one thing it really means is that no one cares. They don't read
their heart
shit.
Is not in it.
Their heart is not in it. So
and
it's like,
and there's not an audience there either.
No, when it's like, you know, how climate change affects black women. This is actually a real piece that I actually came across, but like it hits black women the hardest because you look at the numbers of that, nobody read it. Nobody. But it made everyone feel good that they published it, but nobody read it. And that's the important point.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say, like, another cancelable opinion, but like on both the right and the left is, The public figure today who would be most recognizable to the New York Post of the 1940s and 50s is Donald Trump.
I think it's demonstrably true. Yeah.
He is like a New Deal Democrat, essentially.
Yeah.
All of his views are, he's the most left-wing candidate that I think president we've ever had. If you're looking just in terms of somebody who represents labor, somebody who represents the interests of the working class, somebody who represents their values.
You know? I would say that he's most left-wing Republican for sure. I can't think of, can you think of a Republican? I mean, Eisenhower was just kind of boring.
I mean, but, like, this guy FDR is sort of like...
No, I'm saying as a Republican. I mean, like, there was a point where Republicans became co-opted by, and this is kind of a pivot moment for politics, in New York by people like John Lindsay. I mean, John Lindsay is a tall, handsome guy who is indistinguishable from a Democrat, which is why William F. Buckley ran against him for mayor.
And you have the sort of Northeastern Lincoln Chafee, Bill Weld.
Yeah, those types of things. But as far as the Republican, I'm sure it's probably about right. But because of the coarseness of Donald Trump's speech and, you know, what he chooses to emphasize, particularly culture war stuff, people don't want to believe that that's true. Whether or not it is true, they don't care.
And also, I don't think he has like an organized
philosophy,
thought process.
Oh, I totally disagree with that. Yeah.
Tell us why.
Yeah.
Well, this gets into my second book, Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women.
You mean the one they shouldn't buy? Okay, yeah, go ahead.
first of all, Steve Bannon came up with this idea of economic populism. In fact, he probably encouraged the kind of verbal diarrhea and the cultural battles because he had this like famous quote where he said, they're going to be talking about racism 24/7 and we're going to win with economic populism. He said that in 2015, and that's like literally exactly what happened.
Yeah, and people tend to forget that he was Trump's campaign manager.
Exactly. I mean, but, you know, the word that came up the most frequently in Trump's campaign speeches in 2015 was NAFTA, right? Like the number one predictor for whether Trump would win a county was how many deaths of despair there had been, which is totally correlated with...
Would you agree with this? I mean, and to I agree with Matt's point, and I know you don't, that Donald Trump has a bit of a elastic version and vision of ideology. The one thing that he's never changed on is trade.
That is true.
Right. All the way back.
That is his ideology.
That is his ideology.
You're right.
Ideology
he's not an ideological person, but on trade, on the economy,
you can find
on
that
immigration.
In the 80s, he's talking about that. And he's not consistent on many things.
Including immigration, not at all consistent.
Not in immigration. I mean, you see him having 17 different views on abortion, as a lot of people are pointing out now, but this is happening with everybody trying to position themselves as, you know, it's how you win elections.
On abortion, like most Americans have somewhat contradictory views on abortion as well.
Correct.
Like the vast majority
but
of Americans,
though.
It doesn't matter. His views on abortion reflect 75% of Americans.
Oh, I think that it depends on when you pick them. I mean, there's a point with when he's appointing judges and things like that, and when he's giving the stump speeches to sort of religious conservatives, I should say. He is really underscoring in that very Donald Trump way. He's like, I don't like these abortions. We want to get rid of all of them, et cetera. And you see, like, a Carrie Lake is a great person who's just a very bad Trump impersonator in so many ways. And she was like, you know, this 1864 abortion law, she was like, you know, that's great. And now she's like, that's terrible because she's looking at poll numbers. I mean, you see this with everybody.
Okay.
It's not
so
common.
So in my book, Second Class, I traveled around the country for a year and I interviewed working class people to try to figure out who is the American working class and do they still have a fair shot at the American dream. I asked people a lot of questions about their lives, their profile in the books, and also about policy and where they are. And the most astonishing thing I found was that very little separates working class Americans who are liberal from working class Americans who are conservative.
I think that's about right, yeah.
They're very united on the issues, and abortion was one of them. So the most common view I heard from women, especially on abortion, was, I would never get an abortion. I don't like abortion. I'm against abortion philosophically, ideologically, and religiously. But I'm totally against banning it because I wouldn't judge that woman for a decision she would have to make. That's literally Donald Trump's position.
So it wasn't surprising to you when Republicans are getting creamed in all these states like Kansas, et cetera, on all these abortion ballot initiatives and things?
No, because working class people are conservative but also extremely tolerant because when your life is precarious, you don't judge other people. Like, you just don't have that luxury. And yeah, that was exactly what I was hearing. I would never get an abortion, like in a very strict way. And I'm like getting ready to take my pen and put it, okay, against abortion. But then they say, but I'm also really against banning it. You know, like, and that's Donald Trump's position on like so many issues. They were super gay, like including the Christians that I met.
Super tolerant, like, of gay or super
they,
gay.
Like they I met evangelical gay. Christians who like, I met this one woman specifically who I'm thinking of, but this was a very common view. But she was Like, she had a Jewish Star of David in the tile in her floor when you walk in. Like, when she saw my Jewish star, she was like, I've waited my whole life for this.
Yeah.
And proceeded to proselytize me. And when I was leaving.
There a red calf in the backyard.
She gave me her favorite Bible. And she was like, please take this. And I had been there. The reason I met her was because her daughter is a certified nurse's aide from Florida who I was profiling for the book. She's gay, and she's actually, it's her daughter-in-law. She's married to this woman's daughter. So this evangelical Christian who had waited her whole life to proselytize to a Jew, that's how religious she is, handing me her favorite Bible on my way out. And she is very close with her daughter. And we get in the car, and Amy says to me, she was like, I was worried that was going to happen. And then she said, you know, you don't have to take the Bible. You can leave it in the
car. Absolutely take that
Bible. I was like, this is so precious
it's
to me.
It's so lovely. Yeah.
Like that, that is the American working class.
Isn't like, it just wonderful? And I know that you guys probably have more experience over the last few years than I do of traveling the country. The bedrock tolerance of Americans.
I found it really so fucking astonishing. And again, this is another thing that I talked about last night when I was like, how do I was telling you this, our friend here who's sitting in here at dinner tonight, that, you know, how do you get this crowd on your side? They're clearly not people that are going to be on my side. But one of the things I talked to them, and I talked to them about my experiences in Starr County in Texas, the most Hispanic county in America, which I've talked about many times in the show. And the interesting thing of, like, they are working class people, and they're really, really opposed to open borders. And you see all the arched eyebrows and people are like, huh, interesting. And it's like, no, you don't understand. Like, the problem is you think of people in categories, in these big, broad categories that are enormous swaths of land. Asian is the most idiotic thing, but Latino is even dumber. I mean, Asian's pretty fucking dumb considering, like, you know, you tell a Korean person, like, you and Japanese people are like, I'm sorry, wait, hold on, what? I'm sorry, what now? And I mean, I'm talking to these Tejanos, they're like, Jesus Christ, these fucking Hondurans are unbearable. I'm like, what? I'm like, yeah, what do you think, we're the fucking same? And I'm like, no, I don't. But and then they laugh at the idea of Latino. And it's like, people cannot comprehend that after so long of having conversations in media, in watching MSNBC or CNN or reading New York Times, that there is some differentiation between these people, and they might have, you know, slightly odd views to the person in New York. The one number that I thought was so interesting that I was listening to somebody who's talking about this, completely kind of bloodless scholar, not ideological, that said, I think the exit polls showed that like 15% of gay people voted for Donald Trump in 2016, and I think in 2020 it was 40-something%. I mean,
yeah, 15 even seems small.
It even seems small.
I think it was gay men.
But it was gay, maybe it was gay men, but it was an enormous uptick. And this is interesting for people to talk about and figure out why these things are happening. There's a lot of opinions on this. But just the existence of it is what we need to point out to people because they don't understand. The numbers are through the roof for Hispanics. They're so much bigger than they were in 2016 for Black Americans, for gay Americans. So the entire
35% of Black men are polling for Trump. Now, if you remember in 2020, he was polling at 8% of Black men. And he got 18%.
Yeah.
There's like a stigma around admitting it. He's now polling at 30.
I love that it's a Black Bradley effect. It's like, which is itself a racist thing.
Here's my argument. It's like, the reason they became obsessed with the racial categories is because it was a wonderful way to hide the class divide that they were benefiting from and the way that they had abandoned labor. And the thing you're pointing out is that working class people have a lot more commonalities over racial divides in terms of their opinions, in terms of their values, in terms of the economic policy they want to see. I'm sorry, libertarians, but it's not what you guys like. You know, it's like,
We're used to being outnumbered. That's kind of the whole point.
Yeah, but we've been right for so long, we don't even care anymore.
That's true.
Yeah, because this is the world. The world we live in is the one that we want to live in.
But immigration is a really good example. I'll just give like one example of this. So immigration, like these elites, right? Like they benefit from the open border in very real economic terms.
1,000%.
It puts money back in their bank accounts because now they can pay their nanny, you know, $14 an hour instead of $25 an hour and benefits, right? So the open border is like, it puts money in the pocket of the elites And it is wage theft of the working class, right? Because the working class are the ones who are competing with illegal immigrants who are not going to be able to compete with someone in the knowledge industry.
Bernie Sanders' argument for many years, right? Yeah. Which so, he's now, of course, doubled back on because it's not the one.
Not that strongly, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not making it as I mean, there are two things about Sanders in the past that are like two kind of working class things that, you know, to Bonzi's argument, what the elite left doesn't want to embrace anymore. Bernie Sanders was very vocal in his support for the Second Amendment.
Yes, he was.
And support for tighter border restrictions. I mean, he was literally on camera. We never released this as a Vice thing where he was talking about, like, you know, it wasn't me who did this interview. I interviewed a couple times, but there's one, and I have the clip. I asked someone to pull it out of the archive for something we were shooting. We never used it. But it was like, you know, something about guns, and, you know, whoever was interviewing him was outraged about this. And they were surprised by him. And he's like, I'm in Vermont. We have no motors. We got a lot of guns. And it was like, he was literally making an almost NRA argument. But that stuff has kind of disappeared as everyone's fallen in line. But one of the interesting things about what you're saying here is about labor. Because if there's anything that the modern upper middle class, spoiled, went to Barnard lefties and media love to cosplay, it's labor. That's why they've all formed unions.
Totally.
There's unionization drives where? Oh, like in newsrooms.
Right.
In graduate schools. It's like, I love the graduate schools are always like, we're unionizing. It's like, you don't have to be there. This is like, you're learning. You're in school. Why are you? It's so bizarre.
I mean, they at least are underpaid. I read somewhere, I think it was the Washington Post was quoting that the average journalist in the New York Times makes $160,000 a year and they're in a union. I'm like, what's next? The CEO's union? I mean, it's like, it's ridiculous, right? But so here's my question.
And that,
by
the way, I don't believe is from like union pressure. It's been very high for a very long time.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe the union has something to do with it. I have no idea.
Why do you guys have the chutzpah to stand against labor?
Who, me?
Like,
you guys, are you talking about Irish people or
libertarians? So trade,
right?
Immigration, right? Like all of these things.
I got a problem with public sector unions.
Yeah.
You can unionize whatever the fuck you want.
No, I'm not talking about.
Just don't make it cops
unions.
Let's talk
about like immigration and trade, right? Two areas where like the working class is very clear, like total moratorium on immigration, no more free trade. Let's put tariffs on everything.
Let's
right?
put down a marker. You are speaking now, Batya, for the working class.
No, I'm telling you what.
No, you're telling me what the working
I'm
class
telling
is
you
for.
What the data shows.
Okay.
Like that there's like when you look at immigration polling, that like the over under is both based on education and based on income, over $100,000, under $100,000 for support or being against it. And also what like my, you know, 100 interviews yielded was like almost every single person said the same thing about trade and immigration.
A fantastic thing that your book does that few things do in this world is you went out and talked to people and also found yourself surprised by them too, which I find
I don't know why she didn't find rural rage. There was so much rural rage. Where's the rage in this book? No, but I agree with Matt on that too, is that, I mean, I have enormous number of problems with specific unions, particularly their political activities.
Unions. Let's talk
I thought you were wanting to talk about unions.
No. Yeah. I want to talk about trade and immigration.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Because those are two areas that really unite the working class against the college-educated elites that you hate.
Yes.
And yet you
guys as
liberals.
I don't hate anybody. That's a difference.
Yeah.
I swear one hand does.
I honestly don't.
So the people that we can all admit are problematic, right? And are destroying the country. But how come the libertarian, like why do you guys not feel like that you should side with labor on these issues?
Because I don't feel like I have to side with anybody on any issues.
Uh-huh.
I feel like if I think this is a better thing or this is a worse thing, I'm going to think and go for the better thing. There was a period of, I don't know, 60 or 70 years where people in America, in both the leadership and kind of proletariat position, understood or, you know, maybe deluded themselves in believing that if you substantially and gradually and in a large sort of global collective way to the greatest extent cooperative way possible, reduced tariffs, then you would create wealth that could be a bulwark against the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And it worked. It was popular. It worked. You had people like Ronald Reagan, who I know is anathema to everybody in the world now, but who for many, many years, even before he got into politics, talked about how free enterprise was a more moral system than what its opponent was in collectivism and just socialism, democratic socialism. You had places who were championing labor in the name of labor and running countries into the fucking ground, right? And the UK was a big labor country in the 1970s. The UK sucked in the 1970s. It was a shithole country.
I mean, you remember the Saatchi ad, one of the greatest political ads of all time, which is a dole queue. And it, and the great double entendre just said, labor is not working, which is a fantastic, one of the greatest ads. But no, I mean, that was the state clotting things up. And just to say, you know, just broadly, because we're speaking broadly about these things, I wouldn't say that I am opposed to kind of labor, or I'm not on the side. Like, I'll give you a weird example, and that would probably produce a number of listener eye rolls. But I, you know, I said on this podcast when the, at the writer's strike, in Hollywood, it doesn't make a difference if they're rich Hollywood people. It's still a writer's strike. And you would presume that I would be on the other side. But I saw a friend of mine who's in Hollywood explain this to me. And I was like, oh, yeah, they have a point. This actually makes total sense. I'm totally fine with those things. I'm totally fine with there's some sort of fairness. I say, when it comes to tariffs and trade, I think that there's just very little evidence to support some. Like, I mean, Donald Trump has suggested a 10% tariff on everything coming to the country is the wildest, genius stupidest idea. Thing. You think it's good?
I think it's, first of all, I think saying that is
well, that's political. Brilliant.
Yeah. It's because working class people, like, I think I fundamentally.
But if they don't do it, it's tricking them, isn't it?
I cannot accept that a person who has less than $100 in their bank account, who is living on a shoestring budget, who knows, like, to the pennies how much money they have, is wrong looking over the last 20 years about what policy, what administration, what politician is putting money in their pockets or taking money out of it. Like, I just reject that idea that people who have so much less than us are going to be wrong about that because they can't afford to, like, literally. And they see the impact of this. Like, working class people have really strong opinions about trade and tariffs in ways that, like, the elites don't, because they just – I mean, what's inflation? Like, 18% in groceries. Like, do people who are in the, like, professional managerial class even notice that? I mean, barely, you know?
Absolutely not. Nobody notices it. They don't – I mean, we talk about the George H.W. Bush and the scanner with the – going to the grocery store and the prices of milk. And it's, you know, it's a bit of shaded here and there. And that is true. That kind of – that disassociation from what is happening in the world is real. And I agree with you on that. And I agree with you on the kind of broader point of it, but my where I disagree with you is that if you say to somebody at a 10% tariff, you're saying to people who don't really know a lot about the economics of this, and just saying, like, look, I saw this when I went to a aluminum smelter that was opening up because of Donald Trump's tariffs, which I think is probably closing. I can't remember, I have to look it up, but the ideas that people had is like, well, we'll just put a tariff on all this stuff. And that now Biden, of course, has continued this, talking about putting a tariff on Mexican steel now, which is going to be, we're not going to have enough steel at this point.
He had a big speech 2 days ago saying we're going to triple tariffs on Chinese steel.
Yeah, the triple secret probation. It's just, it's already tariffed.
Wait, but can I just
into a point? Let me just finish this quickly. I understand of you say it's brilliant to say 10% politically. You cannot find an economist who has an advanced degree in anything that will tell you that a 10% tariff, which is a 10% tax on the poor, will say this is a good policy. Now, I agree with you in the sense that that will motivate people. And I do actually, weirdly, think that having these conversations now is something that we stopped having. Like, there were no conversations about this in the 1990s. I'm glad that those conversations. It was only Michael Moore.
There was a WTO protest in 1999.
That was the elite kind of, like.
No, it was hard hats and fucking turtles,
but
man.
Those were kids in balaclavas, and the WTOs, particularly in Europe when they were doing all this stuff. And Michael Moore's downsized this, et cetera. That was kind of a thing that you'd be like, oh, those lefties talking about it. I don't mind the fact that Republicans are actually understanding this, that these are their core constituents. You know, Tom Frank saying, what's the matter with Kansas? Why aren't these people like what I want them to be? It's like, why do they care about abortion? They should care about this. It's like, well, it's not an either or, number one. And number two, Republicans should have taken from things like that in that book. It's like, yeah, we do have to pay attention to working class concerns. My difference with you is that the solution to those problems should not be a version of utopianism, that we can get rid of all this foreign competition by raising the trade barriers. And we have hundreds of years of evidence that says this does not work. Does it have costs? Of course. Were we bad at pointing that out, saying globalization's great? Yes, of course. There should have been training programs, but a million different things. But to say that it is a net positive is something that literally 95% of economists agree on.
I'm so glad you phrased it that way, because that's like the easiest way for me to like completely just respond to it. But first of all, the fact that Biden is carrying on Trump's tariffs, that is why I said Trump is the most left-wing president we've ever had.
Oh, no,
had.
I agree.
Not the most left-wing Republican.
Yeah.
Because everything left that Biden has done in terms of economic policy has been a continuation of Trump, who showed up and turned the ship around. He took on both parties, right? There was like a handshake agreement between both parties on free trade, and that is gone. I mean, no one is going to be able to go back. There will never be another thing like
that. Biden is much more of a regulator than Trump was, which is also a left-wing value.
I don't know that that's a left-wing value. I mean,
it is.
Well, okay, I don't like it. I'm not into regulation. I'm not that kind of a left-wing.
Well, one of the great deregulators was Jimmy Carter, but yeah. And which you mentioned in your book, by the way, but we'll talk about that too.
The thing about first of all, I think there's a lot of evidence that the tariffs worked. I think steel and aluminum are a really good example. The average steel worker who works, by the way, in the South, right? They moved all the steel mills to the South so they wouldn't have to, because there's no union, the right to work, right? So the average pay in right to work states is $88,000 a year, which in much of the South is a middle class wage. And I mean, it's directly tied to the tariffs. I mean, and yes, the price of steel and aluminum did go up a little bit after he announced the 25% tariffs, which is much higher than 10%. But it regulated because of free market within the United States. So I disagree with the idea that this is like some sort of utopianism. Like, it was actually really smart. And now we do have enough steel and people are able to afford. It's not that the price has gone up despite the fact that wages are being protected. It's the perfect example of how to do this. Maybe like a blanket 10% would, you know, is a little too extreme. But the fact that he's even thinking
let's
in that
talk about
manner,
a blanket. That's when I say
do we have more steel jobs than we did 6 years ago?
We don't have less.
I think we do.
We don't have less.
All right, let's bet. We'll bet on that.
But the thing about the economists is this. You know, 100% of economists will also tell you that immigration raises the GDP, right?
No.
You will not find an economist very few will not point that out.
I think it's a hotbed of interesting research, specifically what that does to lower domestic.
It is actually not a hotbed of research it does to domestic. No, it is not. And that's
sure,
exactly
George,
the
what's
point.
His face? George Borjas from Harvard, right? This has been an ongoing conversation for the last 10 years of that high immigration reduces the working class wage in America. And the question is, how tolerable is that? Is that good? Do the otherwise good benefits of immigration outweigh that? To what degree is that depressing wages? Not. It's been an active.
It's actually really not an act. I mean, the vast majority of economists will simply point out that, you know, immigration is good for the GDP. And
for
they
as
will
much
not-
shit as you talk about libertarians, we've talked about, we have written about George Borjas's work on immigration, who is not a libertarian. He's anti-libertarian on the issue. Probably, you know,
George Borjas is the one
25
guy
times
pointing this out. And every time he points it out, he gets crushed by the entire economics discipline, who refuse to admit that GDP in the aggregate is a meaningless statistic because we don't live in the aggregate. And of course, all of the gains of immigration have gone to the elites, like we pointed out earlier.
The median household income in this country was $55,000 40 years ago. It's $75,000 now. And that's adjusted for inflation. Like, we haven't starved because of whatever the hell it is that we're doing.
But people can't afford homes. They can't afford healthcare. They can't afford education. They can't afford to retire. That's the story of my book. Yeah, they're not starving. You're right.
They're not homeless, but they can't achieve the American dream.
They cannot achieve the stability of the American dream that the average working class person in the 70s could achieve. And that's due to – because those things, the things that are the hallmarks of a middle-class life and the American dream have become unaffordable.
In some places, yes, absolutely. But in other places, not, right? Like, it's affordable to live in Texas. It is not affordable to live in Southern California.
The point I make in the book is that the American dream is easier to achieve for working class people in red America, 100%. But healthcare, that is like across the board.
Butcher, when I see this, I just had to pull this up because I read it the other day, and there's plenty of these similar ones, and listeners can go find these. When you see this, this is the first paragraph of a piece in the Times. The sweeping tariffs that former President Donald Trump imposed on China and other American trading partners were simultaneously a political success and an economic failure, a new study suggests. There's a bunch of these studies and this, you know, these kind of supposedly nonpartisan things. I don't know. I haven't looked at this one in particular. So when you have a bunch of studies like this, I mean, do you believe, and I know you can't address this specifically because you don't have it in
the New York Times positively because it's like.
No, I'm citing the New York Times.
Which proves my point, by the way.
No. Well, I don't dismiss them out of hand for everything.
I know.
I am saying that the trade reporter there, Anna Swanson, she is. I'm trying to figure out which of these, the nonpartisan working paper.
The studies there's a lot of these, right? Aggregate, right? Mm-hmm. The studies measure GDP in the aggregate.
Okay? This is about employment, that there was a slight decrease in jobs in all of these places. But let's get to the, when I was talking about the utopianism, we talk about a 10% tariff on everything coming into the country. I mean, that is clearly going to raise prices on everyone, right?
Well, it depends on what.
I mean, on everything.
Everything.
Right? Everything that's imported, then will be.
Has pieces of things that are imported.
Which is most things. I mean, Donald Trump said we're going to make the iPhones in America, which was, it's actually impossible. You cannot do that. You need that global supply chain to get all those things that we cannot actually produce in America from coltan that you get in Congo to, you know, pieces of graphite that you get here and there. But like, it's going to have an effect on people, right?
Coltan is an actual like competitive advantage that the Congo has, right? Like that's an actual mineral, right? That we can't get here. The iPhones that are made in China are not made. The competitive advantage
they're assembled in China,
that China has in terms of assembly is like slave labor, right? Like that's and that should not be a competitive advantage. Like,
so there was an economic study because I did a documentary on this for HBO, and we talked to a couple of economists, and we kind of agreed on. You know, looking at all their studies and saying that, you know, the iPhone that you buy for $500 or $600 would be a couple thousand, maybe 2,000 to 3,000 if everything was actually sourced in America because of labor costs, et cetera, like, you know, regulations, things like that. I mean, you can't deny that things are going to be more expensive, right?
Don't you think that the American people should have the choice of whether, like, to be homeowners and have affordable health care and have these hallmarks of a middle-class life that they can afford because their jobs pay more, and the price of that will be, so I won't have an iPhone. I won't get a new iPhone every year. I won't get a new flat-screen TV. For $75.
Well, then Republicans lose if you can't get. I mean, look,
I don't agree. I think the elites like cheap shit from China and the working class.
Who shops at Walmart? Is it the elites?
I was interviewing a guy. This is a true story. I was interviewing a guy.
No, what I'm saying is that they should have the choice of whether they would rather have a 1970s style economy in which they can achieve the security of a middle class life at the cost of the flat screen TV. I think people should have that choice. Do you not think they should have that choice?
Wait, hold on. Why don't they have that choice? You can't buy things that are made in America because, you know, they're more expensive, right? They'll be made here if we have the capabilities of making them, and they'll be maybe 5 times more expensive, 4 times more expensive. What's stopping companies from making them in America and trying out that market? Because no one's going to buy them, right?
I mean, no, because the corporations obviously are making bank by producing cheap in China and then importing them here. Like,
but what if some company said, I'm going to try to compete and say, it's, you know, I'm going to make this in America. It's going to be more expensive. I'm going to market it that way. How come those places?
I think that's the Tesla model. And they're doing really well.
Yeah, I mean, but you don't obviously like their labor policies, right?
I have no problem with their labor policies.
You don't?
No.
Okay, you don't mind that they don't allow unions?
No.
Okay. Well, no, that's interesting. I didn't know. I figured you'd be upset about that. But yeah, I mean, but those are, first of all, they're cars that are partially subsidized by the government because you get $7,500 for the government
in China.
and the batteries are in China, et cetera. That's what globalization is in a way. I mean, it's a great example of like everything is interconnected. When you try to break those connections, you start breaking a lot of things. I wish it were true that if we just buy things here and just, you know, keep everything out of the country, that we would have cheap healthcare or people would be able to afford healthcare. There's so many problems with all of those things individually that I not only don't think trade's going to solve, but I think that higher tariffs in the
trade is the answer to everything.
No, but it's part of it. What is the problem with it though is that when people are told that it's going to be a panacea, that your jobs will come back if we prevent people from buying cheap stuff. It's not going to happen.
No, I don't think it works that way. Nobody thinks this is a panacea. It's the immigration.
That's just bad policy.
Immigration is a piece of it. Tariffs are a piece of it. Zoning laws are a piece of it. All of this you can read more about in my book, Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. But there were many pieces of the puzzle.
I'm going to delete that.
Degree requirements where there shouldn't be. Vocational training that we defunded. You know,
I totally,
there's a mosaic here of ways in which the elites created a policy that squeezed them up into the top and squeezed working class people down into a life of precarity. And there are a lot of working class people who have achieved the American dream in the book too. It is complex. It can be achieved. But there are a lot of people who work really, really hard and their lives are beset by precariousness despite the fact that they have done everything right and made every right decision. And each of these is a piece of the puzzle that would shift the balance a little bit and take some of that. You know, the top 20% controls 50% of the GDP?
Yeah.
Like that, let's get some of that moving back in the direction of the working class. And yeah, that's going to have an impact on GDP.
By taxing?
Our democracy will be a lot more stable. No, I'm against this whole like redistribution. This is not redistribution. Working class people don't like redistribution. They don't like welfare. Why are you looking at me like that? You haven't read the book? The book is very anti-welfare and redistribution.
No, because you're saying working class people and then telling me what they're
based
saying.
On the studies.
I know, and lots of interviews. Do working class people in your
estimation? I'm not going to be able to answer that now because he's going to give me the stink eye.
I'm not stinking, I'm thinking, I'm setting Matt up to yell at you.
What do you think I'm doing here? I know what I'm doing.
Am I allowed to, it's good, right? To debate on the show?
Yeah, of course. Please. No, we appreciate this, but I'm just saying this. We'll get to go and see. But what kind of agency do working class people have in all of this? I mean, I remember having this conversation with somebody sitting in his living room, really nice guy who worked at, it might have been the aluminum smelter. It might have been somebody. It was a non-union car factory that, you know, it's one of these Toyota that, you know, they go into these right to work states. And, you know, when all the American car companies were falling apart, they were fine. They were staying competitive. But he was talking about this. He was talking about how he wanted to vote for Bernie Sanders, and then he'd blame the DNC for running them out of town, and then he was going to vote for Donald Trump. So he was a perfect guy to interview. And his wife came in, and swaddling about 50 bags from Walmart, in a place where there's probably, that's where you shop. And I asked him about it. I was like, you know, you do get the benefits of this in some ways. And do working class people have it? Like, can they shop local? Can they say, we're going to buy American? You know, Ford F-150s everywhere in the country, right? There's not a lot of, Mercedes and things like this.
Right now, they can't afford it because they can't afford anything because of inflation. So it's like I'm sure they would love to, but because of the wages problem, which is directly tied to the trade and the immigration questions, I don't know that they could afford it.
Wages are outpacing inflation now, though, aren't they?
No, they're definitely not.
They absolutely are.
18% groceries are up 18%. You think?
No, I'm saying wages are outpacing inflation at the moment.
That's not
yeah.
true.
All right, well, look at that.
And also, you know, he just opened the borders. 10 million more people working here than there were before the Biden administration. I mean, that's going to have a huge impact on wages. I forgot what I was going to say. It probably wasn't that important.
Agency.
Can I just say, yes, I'll make one and then you close us out.
Yeah.
There is a huge...
Wage growth has actually outpaced the crushing inflation over the past 2.5 years. Fortune Magazine.
That's just like, it's demonstrably not true.
After the pig was, you know, of course. Python swallowed the pig, right?
Of course. Like, yeah. No, I mean,
it's not going to be like...
No, on its own, it's meaningless. Yeah. I mean, these wages are rising because inflation's rising and workers are demanding it. I mean, they can't afford anything, but continue. Sorry.
I was just going to say about agency, there's a huge spiritual crisis as well in the working class that's related to you know, the war on masculinity, I think, and the way that we've sort of effectively criminalized being a man and being a provider, and culturally, the elites sort of got this, you know, this very feminized culture. It's so funny, the Boys on the Bus, they now made a version of it, and it's women.
Oh my God, did you watch it?
I didn't. I can't.
I heard that it was literally the worst.
Right, but that's
slightly worse than Hitler, yes.
It was
like a girls in the bus thing, and of course—
They took the Boys on the Bus, that, you know, the book about like campaigns.
Yeah, of course.
It's like a Showtime thing.
Turned it into like, it's perfect. I wouldn't have had to write Bad News if that movie had come out before.
Is it called The Girls girls on the bus.
No. But it's basically that. And
and of course, one of them immediately sleeps with one of her sources because you can't be a journalism book without the talking to source. Great.
But yeah, I think this spiritual crisis, the crisis of masculinity, like working class men have being told constantly, like, you ain't shit, you're nothing, like having their wages undercut by illegal migrants and having good jobs shipped over, like all of this contributes to there are 7 million men missing from the workforce. I interviewed people in towns where there were good manufacturing jobs and they couldn't get their son or their brother or their father or their husband to take these jobs. They couldn't get them to show up on time.
Yeah.
The people who were offering the jobs couldn't find people who could pass a drug test. Like, this is all real. Like, this is all not going to be solved by economic policy.
One thing I wanted
to... I had a conversation just to throw listeners back with Nicholas Ebersolt about that. About a year and a half.
Yeah, that's right. You should listen to that one. Yeah, it's a solo, Matt and Nick Eberstadt. One thing I would be remiss in pointing out, and I want to point this out, is that it's not just trade. It's not just immigration. And the one thing we're leaving on the table here is technology.
Culture. Oh, also culture.
Technology changes things, right? I mean, there was an enormous resistance to the tractor. Because you would sow the fields of 50 people and then all of a sudden one person was doing it. And so technological changes, I mean, we can stand athwart technology yelling stop, but is that going to make us competitive in the long run? But it is true that technology, I mean, and everybody agrees on this, there is more manufacturing in America than there's ever been, but with far fewer people. And that's because of automation and technology. What do you think and what do you think we should do about those technological innovations that eliminate jobs?
I mean, people are still making the cars. They're just making them in China. Like, it's like there's 5 million jobs that we ship to China and Mexico because of
that. We make a lot of cars in America.
Huh?
We make a lot of cars in America.
We do. But I'm saying, like, most of these jobs are still... They still exist. There's still people doing them. They're just in other countries. Or service industry jobs, right? We're always going to need service industry people. We're always going to need skilled trades folks.
A few of them now. I mean, I went to get my daughter, we were in Williamsburg, we went to Shake Shack, and there was only kiosks. There was no person waiting on me. And they eliminated, all those jobs have been gone.
Minimum wage and automation.
It's minimum wage and automation. I mean, what would you do about that? Would you say that there has to be is there a legislative solution to this?
I first of all would have no problem with that, but I think that it's overstated. I think there's been some of that, but there's been much more of simply opening the border to illegal, unprotected, low-wage competition.
In certain industries, yeah.
And for sure. If you take the graph of like immigration, like the percentage of Americans who are foreign-born and the graph of working-class wages, I'm making a crisscross with my hands. Mm-hmm. See this in my book, Second Class.
What's the name of your book? No.
It goes like this. And like, yeah, maybe it's correlation, but like certainly some of it is causation because the majority of immigrants work in jobs that don't require a college degree. So the impact on the wages is going to be localized in, you know, the jobs of people who are working class, the competition, which drives down wage. I mean, it's like obvious supply and demand. You know, I'm not against, like, I think the free market is incredibly important and needs to be protected in many ways. I think in healthcare, like, there's a real opportunity for the libertarians I'm trying to, like, open this because the most, like, common set of views, combination of views I found among the, like, 100 people that I interviewed was, like, pro-gay and worried about trans, like, very against the trans thing. It was against welfare, but for higher taxes on the rich. And it was against immigration, like, let's have a total moratorium on legal and illegal immigration for the foreseeable future and some sort of government-backed healthcare plan. I thought this was going to be very palatable to liberals because it would be so easy for the Democrats to turn this
program. Trans thing
gets
you all fucked up, though.
The immigration thing. No, they're not willing to give on the immigration thing because of their donor class and the NGOs and all of this. But actually, it's Republicans who are super open to hearing this from me. Like, I thought the minute I said the word healthcare, I'd be like booed off and I'd never be invited anywhere again.
No, Marco Rubio and Josh Hawley love
that stuff. Into it. But I think that this is an opening for libertarians to come up with like a real policy to crush the cartels in these industries because it's so gross. I mean, it's so gross.
How certificate of need. No, seriously. Like, if you want to go back and find like crushing cartel work, there's decades worth of the shit. Certificates of need are a classic. They're anti-competitive. you allow the hospital to say, nah, we're not going to allow the other hospital to open up. No, I mean,
libertarians
spend a lot of time, the ones who are not actually talking about national politics, but are actually trying to help local politics, they spend a lot of time on, largely speaking, on a project that I think would help everybody in this conversation, regardless of where they're coming from, it, which is to reduce prices.
Yeah, so this is an actually interesting thing, and I'm you know, not all the way through your book, but I plan on getting through. We should probably have you on after. We'll have you come back after I've finished it. But the thing on prices is pretty interesting. I mean, you have something like, I mean, Jimmy Carter deregulates a number of things. One of them, we talk about trucking, you mentioned in the book, but the airline industry is pretty interesting because, you know, I think it was Milton Friedman who said the biggest enemy of capitalism are capitalists because they like closing down their markets. They like hugging that market share and using the might of the government to keep other competition out. And you have something like the deregulation of the airline industry. And then there was just this flourishing of other airlines, and travel became a lot cheaper for people. And that's everybody. That's working class people. That's average people. I mean, you see that in Europe with all these, you know, Ryanair and stuff. Ryanair. People can travel and like... It democratized travel in a way that it created some class hatreds, like because it's like British people, you know, like soccer hooligans going to Czechoslovakia, like Czech Republic, and being like banned from places. Like,
yeah, no, well,
you got
party.
Fucking castles here. Can we fucking see them?
Literally like, signs. Can we regulate? In English, no stag parties, it's no hen
no
parties.
No stag parties, no hen parties. But that thing also about prices, and it leads me, I know you have to go, and I want to ask you one final thing about this, is that there are, I mean, what I think, and I don't identify as a libertarian. I have instincts of libertarianism, but I think my brief association with reason has made me just a libertarian, but I'm not necessarily just a libertarian. But one of the things I think that libertarians are conscious of is like the diminishing returns, right? We want, you know, working class people say they want to tax the rich more. You want a higher minimum wage, things like this. Want more higher tariffs.
Higher minimum wage was not one of the things I found.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that right? Interesting.
Like they would say,
it doesn't affect most people.
They would say, like, I don't see how anyone could live on less than $20 an hour, but that a minimum wage is not a pathway for upward mobility.
And it's mostly, you know? When you look at it, it's mostly like summer jobs
exactly.
and various
high
things.
High school kids.
But high school kids and everything. But all of those things, which people do campaign on, and who was talking about the other day, $50 minimum wage or $40?
Yeah,
I saw this, like maybe it was Bobby Kennedy or something. But there is a point, would you not agree, in which the taxation of the rich, the tariffs on cheap goods coming in, is going to hurt.
I don't think those are the same. Like, I feel like you think I have a kind of Democrat model in thinking about this.
Oh, I just don't know. I honestly don't know.
But that I'm trying to describe like a middle lane that I think Trump really embodied really well, which was deregulation. Like they don't like regulations because like small businesses are like hugely penalized by regulation. But actually, if you look at a place like, you know, like Scandinavia is actually low regulation, low
Very
corporate
low.
Taxes,
yes.
right? Like that thing where you're sort of creating
it's a big welfare state and a capitalist society.
Exactly. Yeah. You create a protectionist economy, protecting labor, protecting the hard work of the people who work the hardest. You know, the obviously, like, we all love the idea of a meritocracy. Like, you know, if there's some genius kid, like, in the ghetto, like, they should really get to, like, make it and become, like, a millionaire and whatever. Yeah. Like, I totally support that. But even the fantasy of the meritocracy is based on the idea that if you are exceptional, you know, you should be able to go as far as your talents take you, right? Like this idea that like if you have an IQ of 180, you know, if you're uniquely talented in some way, that you should be able to make it. And my thing is like, what about everybody else? Like our economy actually relies on our comfort in a big way relies on people who are not exceptional, whose jobs require maybe the patience of sitting in traffic in a truck, or maybe the patience of changing the diapers of old people with dementia who really don't want their diapers changed, right? We all rely on this like godlike labor of people who need to be good at their jobs but are in no way exceptional. And as a society, I think we've decided they can just suck it. Like they can just like that. We should want them to have the most modest version of a stable life that they don't have to worry that they don't have a penny saved for retirement because it goes to healthcare every single year to some enormous deductible that they don't have to worry that they'll never be able to buy a home and never be able to retire in dignity or leave something to their children. Like stuff we take so for granted. Like there's something here that is so deeply unfair, and I rebel against it. And I think that, you know, as a, like, I don't know, like, I feel it spiritually, but it's like, even people who want just like prosperity for the most amount of people, who want people to be able to achieve the most on their merits, like, we do rely on people who are not exceptional, and we should recognize that and want them to live in stability. If we care about our democracy, like if we care about the stability of this country, that, I guess that's my pitch.
Yeah, I would say, and I would say the final thing on this, and I get that too. I mean, I would be very surprised if any of the people that I know don't want the exact same thing, which is broad prosperity for the broadest number of people that we can. I think obviously we have different ways of getting there. I mean, I think that, you know, when you're trying to save 100 jobs or, you know, 500 jobs, and it will have an adverse effect on, you know, 500,000 people, I mean, that's where my calculation comes in. I wonder politically too, and this is just a, you know, thought experiment of this, if bigger tariffs that were not targeted on steel and on aluminum and these things that are coming from China and, you know, Canada, we've, you know, waged a trade war on them too, and in Mexico, if those prices were to go up, and a 10% tariff and everything, I wonder how long Donald Trump would last, because you see fluctuations of 3%, 4%, 5% because of inflation, and people are outraged by it. Oh. I wonder if people going into a Walmart and seeing as a result of these, which are, you know, themselves inflationary, is seeing these prices so much higher. I think that even granting everything to you, that we have gotten used to that way of living. We have gotten used to getting an iPhone when the new one comes out and it be kind of disposable. Rewiring people on that and making everything very expensive. Like, you know, you talk to people about climate change and you say, well, what's the solution to this? And they say, well, one of the things that nobody's ever going to like is basically just higher gas taxes, because we want people to emit less carbon, and that's just not going to work. It works better in Europe because they drive shorter distances, number one, and they've had it for so long. Like, it's basically $9, $10 a gallon for gas in Sweden, but Sweden's not a huge country. You're not driving from here to Vermont, to Chicago or something. So I wonder, just in a real world way, and this is speculative, we don't know because it hasn't happened in that way yet, but if everything becomes more expensive, will the average person be thinking about that in a place where there, you know, wasn't a lot of factories that closed down, or they closed down long enough ago that they've accepted the new reality? It's not like we can look forever, because, you know, Scott Linsicum, who I'm sure you hate, who I really like, you know, has pointed out a lot of these places that have gone the way of like Youngstown have been sort of revivified in totally different industries. And that's just how economies work over time.
I'm totally open to the idea that this would fail, and yeah, then people would change their minds and then, you know, go back to some other thing. Like, yeah, that's completely possible. But yeah, I think they have the right to have what they want happen. And like, I think a lot of this stuff is connected, and it's, you know, not necessarily we're going to bring back this factory or that factory, but like all taken together, the idea of like just bringing, like having a little bit more respect for these people because they feel the contempt of the elites and elite policy very keenly.
I love that we're ending on something.
I know, but also I have to say, I just have to tell the audience, because like I obviously noticed this, but like, Matt has been sitting here. Every time I say something, he has 30,000 things he wants to say back to me that he thinks would disprove me. And he's been so generous kind and gentle, and just let me meet him.
We don't do that kind of podcast. You're
mistaking the blank, like, thousand-yard stare.
He's thinking about,
it's
like,
very obvious.
His kids are pains in the asses.
No, and you're like, and your listeners should know.
I don't know where my 15-year-old's going to high school next year.
No, I will say we get a lot of shit for our dear friend Andrew Sullivan coming on and talking about Israel and just being wrong about a bunch of stuff. And we just let him go. I mean, first of all, because he was very stoned. But people are like, "What? Like, why didn't you like attack Andrew on that? What is wrong with you guys?" And I'm like, have you not listened to this podcast? We try to allow people to go. We get it. We mix it up sometimes, as we just did. But, you know, it's important that people hear and this argument. And the best thing for us, and I think this is actually true, and this, I don't know why our listeners would give a shit about the kind of mechanics of the business, such as it is, that we run. But it's also really good for our listeners, because our listeners go into the comment section in our Substack and they have these enormous conversations about this stuff. And this is the great thing about this. It will create, you know, a million jumping off points for this conversation.
And I would say, in addition to people like singling you out as someone that they wanted to hear on the show,
yeah.
Of all,
I don't know why they like you so much. You clearly a psycho.
Extra names always
clearly
wins.
Clearly deranged.
Is that
Israeli Jimmy Hoffa?
Of the few things that the three of us broadly agree on, one of them that irritate people the most is trade. They're like, how come you never have someone?
It's really common.
Who it's does really so, common. Like, this is yeah. fan service.
See you in the comments,
here.
Guys.
Yeah, yeah. See you in the, yeah, we'll make sure you're in there, because it's always like, well, you know, David Otter's studies about China and the great sucking sound. I'm like, yeah, I know. But, you know, I have to say, we haven't had a lot of, like, pro-trade people on either. It's just, it hasn't come up that much. But I did.
Johan. We had Johan.
We had Johan on. But I would advise Batya, and I hope that listeners will take me up on this too, is if you go onto YouTube and find the documentary that I did for HBO called Trump's Trade War, which I laughed about the other night, because in front of an audience of people, because I said, you know, we went to HBO and said, can we do an hour documentary on trade? And we were like chuckling each other. They said, yes. And we're like, I'm sorry, what? They're like, yeah, no, you can. And I was like, are you guys fucking, you going out of business? Like, I know Vice is, but are you guys kidding? So we went around the country for almost a year. And there's a bunch, and I really don't think, there's a couple of moments you see that I like trade a lot, but I hope that you watch it, and I hope that you get the sense that we treated those people seriously, who got jobs back. We went to people who the aluminum smelter was laying people off, and we went and saw them. And there's a guy, and they took a bit of this and put it on John Oliver's show. And I was very impressed by them, because I don't like them at all. But they cut it off before they could humiliate the guy, because the guy just starts weeping. Aww. And talking about how, and it's like funny. We didn't leave it in because it was funny, because it was like, and I said, what would you say to President Trump if you came across him? And the funny thing about it is, and it doesn't matter who it is, what the situation, because it's just that situation I'm seeing. He's like, I would say, I love you, man. And he starts crying. And they cut it off before that, which was, I thought, was very, very respectful.
That's actually
because
surprising.
It was like a surprising and nice, because they could have taken it and said, look at this MAGA dope weeping over Donald Trump. But we left that in there, and we left that conversation in there, because there was a whole family that had worked in that aluminum smelter of three generations, and how important that was to them. And like, do I think that that's great economic policy in the long run? No, I don't at all. But I really understood why it was important to these people. And we put that in there. And I really hope people go and watch it, because my producer, Sean Killebrew, and I, we went across the country for a long time and put a lot of effort into that.
Is there something else you hope people will read, maybe?
No. There's a book out by this woman with three names. It's like almost a WASPy thing to have three names, but I don't know where she's from. It's very foreign. She might be.
Yeah.
She's taking American jobs. You know, Americans could be writing these fucking books, and then we have these people in there. I think they're Israeli. I don't even know where they're from. Boston. But yeah.
I am from Boston.
Yes, I am too. So that's why we allow you on the show. Mm-hmm. This anti-Semitic pro-trade show has had Batya Ungar-Sargon, one of my favorite people and a great person to have these conversations with, because unfortunately she's smart, and a lot of the people that talk about this stuff are not. So Batya, plug the book and make people go buy it.
Yeah, buy the book, but also thank you guys so much for having me. And also, like, from the bottom of my heart as a Jewish person, I just have to say thank you. You've both been amazing, and you've made a lot of us feel a lot less alone in the world at a crucial time. And I don't really have the words to say it, but I know you hear this from a lot of people, and thank you so much.
We don't, but I have told you before, I only want to be referred to as Oscar Schindler from now on out.
It's in the writer, actually.
It is in the writer. Yeah, that's. And for the Jewish people, this is Oscar Schindler. And my colleague to my right, Raoul Wallenberg, signing off. Bye, people.
Bye.
Bye. And bye, Batya's book, even though it's wrong.
We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse.